Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. You may not know the name Alan Blanco, but something tells me you soon will. This young filmmaker and Penn State graduate is making a name for himself. His debut feature film, Manos Sucias, with first-time director Joseph Vlatica, has made the film festival rounds to critical acclaim. Blanco co-wrote and shot the film, which was executive produced by Spike Lee. The deeply affecting story is set and shot in a part of the world we rarely see on screen, the drug underworld of Buenaventura, Colombia. Alan Blanco, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Your new film, which is stunning, Manos Sucias, is the story of two estranged brothers, both Afro-Colombian from other fishermen from Buenaventura, Colombia. Give us a synopsis of your film.
Well, Buenaventura is the largest port city on the Pacific coast of Colombia and at times is the epicenter for a lot of the beginnings of the drug trade. And it's a story of that these two estranged brothers who, through circumstances of economic circumstances, societal circumstances, are put on this job together where they're towing a torpedo full of cocaine submerged under the water behind their fishing boat. And it's one of the many different ways that cocaine kind of makes its way into the country.
In fact, according to the U.S. Coast Guard, 250 tons of cocaine are transported exactly as you described in your film.
Yeah, and it can range from fully submersible submarines to these torpedoes. It's just a lot of ways of sort of bringing the product into the country. And while there's been a lot of films with these sort of larger-than-life characters, like legendary films by like Scarface and things like that, within American cinema specifically too, this particular aspect of the drug trade is not particularly well seen. And this particular part of Colombia, Buenaventura, I believe hadn't really had a lot of attention given to it filmically. And that was something that I know the production team, the director, Joseph Vlatica, and myself were very passionate about trying to work with to bring light to.
This was an ambitious undertaking, even for veteran filmmakers. So here are you and the director, Joe Vlatica, you just mentioned, and a relatively small team going to a place. I want to describe what I read about Buenaventura, mm-hmm. Colombia. Fear and desperation pervade the ramshackle communities. Life has become a litany of horrors in which mass graves, dismembered bodies, torture and sexual abuse are commonplace. A community council leader said, "Not a day goes by in Buenaventura in which you don't hear machine gun fire."
And I do believe that that is very true. But one thing that my experience going there and meeting people in local communities are, there are very wondrous, spiritual, generous people that happen to live in an incredibly difficult environment, but it is still life, and life kind of takes its regular routines and stuff. And something that I know Joe and I wanted to make sure came across in the film was a sense of joy that they can have and the sense of friendships that they can form. Clearly a love of soccer, that's very, very big there. Meanwhile, this pervasive sort of environment in which, because of a global community, a global thirst for drugs, that can really exploit these people.
Well, you get the sense that they're not perpetuating the drug trade. They're trapped in it.
Yeah, I think that could be very true. And I think that as the story was beginning, this is the sort of the life of the film as it came to be was a lot of discovery. And so the project initially was Joseph's before I had met him at film school.
At NYU.
Yes, so at about 2007 is when we met. So just before then, he had started sort of backpacking and just trying to garner more life experience before he was going to try to focus on his artistic identity. And he had stumbled onto these stories, local fishermen, speaking sometimes about the horrors you were talking about, but also about their spirituality and how they live off the water. And, they were kind enough and generous enough to allow him into their homes and into their lives and share their stories. And he knew that there was a story that he wanted to be able to tell. And it was sort of fascinating that our outsiderness, I do believe, was useful in our film, in that we were these sort of gringos coming from, like, the states that make a movie in their town.
Gringos, but Vladika said that one of the things that the community said about you was, here's this Filipino filmmaker, here's this Japanese Polish filmmaker, and your producer is this woman from Brazilian descent who speaks four languages.
Yeah, and our other, you were speaking probably of Marcia Nunes and our other fantastic producer who's also
Elena Greenlee's.
Yes, as well, with an amazing history, a life history of her own from Russia and her connections to Brazil as well, and also being very much one of my favorite New Yorkers, even though she's currently living in San Francisco. But we were a cosmopolitan or like a polyglot kind of crew in a way, and we always knew that we wanted a sense of community. We know that this was stories from this specific area that has a global reach because there's other parts of the world that can resonate with something so similar. So there's this irony that you make a very specific story in this place that not many people see, but people in Southeast Asia, where my parents come from and stuff, they see the same sorts of things. The way that people can be systemically displaced or economically forgotten. And I think that that's one thing that was a joy in a weird way. That's a weird way to say it, but working on this story with people in Buenaventura.
I want to talk more about that because there's actually a very interesting story about this idea of giving back, that you weren't going to just go and tell their story but involve them in it. But before we do that, you were the director of photography, and so your job was to work with the director in providing or figuring out the visual style that was appropriate for telling this particular story.
Well, it's interesting because the story of the film was his research, and then we had gone through school together, and then he had all this information, and then we both worked on the script together. He was kind enough and entrusted in me enough that we could work on this material together, which, I mean, it was very
personal. How do you do that? You know, two writers. I'm not sure how you do with screenplay that way.
I think that comes down to personal process, but we had always been collaborators. I had sound edited commercials that he had worked on, and we kind of looked at edits together sometimes, and we looked at each other's material, and we found we spoke sort of a similar language. We would say, like, it's kind of like we kind of share the same religion about film. Like, the things that we believe are true about the form are what we both like, and there are many valid interpretations of art, obviously, but we happen to have similar ones, and so that got us on the page together. And on the page, writing it was very much about how it was going to look and how we had to practically shoot it.
I'm kind of curious to know why you shot in this dangerous place and didn't use, as so many other filmmakers do, a stand-in like Florida or Cuba to represent Buenaventura.
And there are certainly stronger infrastructures in a place like Puerto Rico, for example. I think like they do like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and things like that there. But speaking specifically about shooting there, it became more and more clear that we wanted the film to be made responsibly and to be made hand in hand in a partnership with the people of Buenaventura. And that literally meant to be there hand in hand and to take their stories and move them to other places that maybe were more not cooperative, but the more conducive to filming. It felt difficult. There really is not many places. There's no other place in the world like Buenaventura. And the heft and the authenticity and the appeal of the film and what we believe would actually make the film special was to go there, be guests, and garner a lot of the truth and a lot of the beauty that is there.
Your director said there was no way you could have gone to Buenaventura and not included the community in this. And no way you could have made the film and just left. You had to give back.
Yes. Explain
what you did.
Throughout a lot of the process of Joe's research, he was already making sort of inroads and friendships and relationships there. But as a production, when we went closer to filming, and this is something I don't recommend most productions do just because of the time it takes, we developed a digital filmmaking workshop for them. These are many students there, and they range from like mid-teens to sort of like early to mid-20s, There's such a thriving artistic community there of both modern music and sort of more traditional music, which is actually in the film very
often. Speaking of music, in this film is spectacular.
And they have a theater program. Like most of the cast is actually were theater students at a university in Buenaventura.
But this is their very first feature film.
First time on film. They weren't used to camera. And that was something that we had to work with them a lot. But so we knew that there was all these artistic identities, and then we had some craft and some technique that we could show them and to have them also like bring up their own stories. So over the course of about a month, once a week we would do our pre-production and then we would go there, and the first one was script writing, and then we developed
and you're actually teaching them in a workshop setting.
And then it was producing, and then we went out and shot it with cell phones, anything you can get your hands on that we thought was going to be possible for them to replicate and move forward with, and then from there were some edits, and then we were able to kind of screen and enjoy their work, and I hope they have continued in being their own advocates with their own artistic voices.
If you are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is filmmaker and Penn State graduate Alan Blanco. He co-wrote and shot Manos Susius with first-time director Joseph Latica. Their debut film about the drug underworld of Buenaventura, Colombia, was executive produced by Spike Lee.
The two main actors in this, who this is their first feature film, and they were just so believable, so spectacular in their performance. There are two scenes in particular that blew me away. One is Jacobo crying over the earlier death of his son. Mm-hmm. And then another where Delio is with his bare hands killing a thief. What was it like for you to shoot those two scenes?
So much about the way the production was made and garnered around was knowing that their performance would be the linchpin or the backbone of the entire film, and both of their journeys. One person who sort of, with Jacobo, it's a person who has been mired in the trade, is closed off, but by re-encountering an estranged brother, begins to let his guard down again, reconnect to feelings that he had kind of, not compartmentalized, but sort of had numbed himself to. And then he ends up sort of breaking down some of these walls because he's been in touch with another person who loves him and can love him and he can love as well. Which has ramifications and consequences in the film afterwards of what happens when you take those walls down. And that scene is indicative of it. And that scene, the performance that Charlie gives is something. And I can't say it other than this. It's like it's an honor to be in the room or in the boat or whatever, and just to be able to photograph something like that.
Well, speaking of in the boat, so here you are, not only in this dangerous place in the world, but you're shooting a lot of this at sea in the Pacific Ocean. And I think of someone like John Huston, who shot much of Moby Dick at sea. And he said it was one of the most difficult films he'd ever made.
It's certainly an unpredictable environment.
You got stranded once, I understand.
Sort of more than once. It depends on how much stranded you want to talk about it. But the tide would go out and we wouldn't be done shooting, and then we would have to kind of slog through the mud to try to get back to water with our gear and stuff like that. But shooting on the water was difficult. It was sort of trying to eliminate any artifice that would prevent the performances from feeling real, I think. And being out there on the water, feeling, just looking out and seeing the vista of emptiness where anything can come at any time. And that was something that I think it really seeps into everything. It certainly seeps into the camera movement, which I'm glad not everybody gets seasick on the crew or anything like that. But
and obviously you didn't.
I did not, and Joe did not. Certain other people might have gotten slightly ill. But it was all part of the physical experience of making the film.
We saw a little clip of another scene that I particularly loved, and that is the two brothers have kidnapped somebody, and they're on these makeshift rail cars. It's a motorcycle attached to what almost looks to me like a picnic table, and they are speeding down this rail, and I'm looking at thinking, wow, the ingenuity and the make-do attitude that must have created such a contraption. And then I'm thinking, here you are out in the Colombian jungle with a crew and no film shop down the street in case something breaks.
Yeah, that's true. we were Canon cameras were gracious enough to donate us. We won a grant that they were going to loan us camera bodies and lenses for us to use. They were kind enough when we asked to have two bodies because we knew it was possible that one might malfunction because of the humidity or just things like that. But so there was a lot of care and a lot of attention, and I had Nick Wynn and Josh Flanagan were my camera team, and they took care of me. They made sure I was safe. Josh is sort of like a very strong person. I think he might have held me by one arm when I was about to fall off of something, either a boat or a, they're called brujitas, which just means little witches, but yeah, he saved me a few times, I'm sure. So it was a lot of just looking out for each other and things like that, and knowing that we didn't have the ability to go to a film shop and do those things. So just going with our bare essentials and that we knew we needed to get the movie done. I mean, if you tried going in there with like a jib or a crane or something, it's just there's not enough manpower, and if anything goes wrong, we need to be low profile enough, almost documentary style, but.
You mentioned documentary, but this was never going to be a documentary for either one of you. What do you think you could do with nonfiction that you couldn't have done had you approached this story as a documentary?
It's a great question, because so much about where the fictitious story of these two people came from were tales and stories that we had heard from friends and families. And I think fictionalizing it and dramatizing it so that it becomes these, not archetypical, but these journeys of ignorance to knowledge for these characters, where you have a naive young kid who thinks one thing about the drug trade and then ends in a different place, and you have a hardened brother who, by reconnecting, ends in another place. There's an emotional connection, and certainly nonfiction films can elicit strong emotional connections, but the way that we wanted to move the audience was something that had to be done dramatically. And I think that it would also was a way, and I do believe we really wanted to make a movie that the people we were making the movie with would also enjoy. And there had
and
been...
And did they?
I think pretty much overwhelmingly. And obviously it's a very difficult subject matter, and it's very... very sensitive and personal to them, and there are many different feelings that it can bring in a person. What we hope is that the film is a part of a conversation, and certainly not a mission statement or anything like that.
We watched your characters change. You mentioned how Jacobo, the older brother, you know, changed when he had his estranged brother reconnecting with him, and Delio is this happy-go-lucky. He wants to climb the ladder of the drug lords. How did this film change the two of you? You and Joe.
Oh, wow. One of Joe and I's favorite film professors is Jose Angel Santana, who still teaches in New York at Columbia, and I believe SVA. But he just casually remarked to me once, I think we were just having coffee or something, and he just says, he's like, you realize the both of you are in that boat, right? And I was like, I understand. He's like, well, like what they're doing, I mean, it's not the same thing, but like you guys are kind of doing the same thing. I mean, it's Joe's debut feature, my first feature as well. The first feature of Marcy and Elena, it certainly was a physical journey, an emotional journey that it was from the inception of the film to now when it's just on the brink of being distributed. And Joe and I, we laugh, we fight. There's some scenes that are taken sort of out of our own sort of behavior. And I think it was a journey that we're definitely different people after making the film, and to a large extent that is an experience and a success that it can't be measured in whether or not enough people go watch it or right. If it makes any money or anything like that.
You mentioned NYU. You actually got your start in film school at Penn State.
Yes.
And there are some people who sort of scoff at, you know, an academic training in filmmaking. Obviously, you and Joe didn't feel that way.
Well, I liked it so much I did it twice.
So undergraduate and then graduate school.
Yeah, and to be honest, the very beginning of my understanding of film as an art form as well as an entertainment medium was here at Penn State. And my first ever film professor was Chuck Unger. And we sat down and we just talked and we became fast friends. And, you know, I didn't know Peckinpah from John Ford for anything until sort of those classes. And, you know, I had, obviously everybody has like this like experience they have as children and discovering the medium. I think the first movie I ever saw in the theater was like Back to the Future. And that's all I ever wanted to have happen. I'm still waiting for my hoverboard, by the way. but just that expansion of what film is and can be, and what your part of it can be if you allow yourself and dedicate yourself to it, I certainly appreciated. Now, you know, people take very different artistic journeys, and I could never invalidate one journey over another, regardless of the success.
But this one worked for you.
This one worked for me. I liked being in environments with similarly minded people, but very disparate personalities, strong personalities. I didn't agree with a lot of people, and they don't always agree with me. And that's part of where, whatever that conflict is part where you kind of can grow as an artist. And going into that environment, I mean, and going back again for my master's, it was like just being able to dedicate more or less 3 years of my life to something I'm passionate about, surrounded by other passionate people and tutored with world-renowned experts in the field. I mean, regardless of what you want to do, even if it's not art or whatever, that's a rare place you can be.
Speaking of experts in the field, not only was this film executive produced by Spike Lee, but he was your teacher and mentor at NYU.
Yeah,
he believed in this project.
He's such a gracious man. He teaches in the third year, and he's the artistic director of the NYU Film Grad Program, and you know he very much gives not only his time, but he was able to supply some grants to various thesis films. This film actually ended up being Joe's thesis film. So Joe's an overachiever. I'm just too long for the ride sometimes, but. He liked the material. I mean, and it doesn't matter whether or not it's a short or a feature. You know, the grant does not change, but the grant was enough to continue the investigation and the research for Joe, and he could go back there and by garnering this information and photographs and stories, and video even. When we went to try to find investment money or try to find financing, we had a wealth.
Crowdsourcing is part of how you. Was it family members? You know, your late mother was a physician, your father was a businessman, and I'm wondering how they felt about you even pursuing, a profession in filmmaking, which can be a very risky thing to do. And so I'm kind of curious to know about their support of your endeavors, and then public support for getting this movie made.
Well, the public support was probably best exemplified with, we did a Kickstarter, which we raised about $60,000, as a large portion of our production budget came from that. But believing it enough to donate whatever they could to the project to have it come true. Now, on the personal level, it's sort of interesting. One thing that bonded Joe and I is that we're both sort of first-gen kids. Our parents were immigrants. And, it's a different experience. I mean, his child experience is different than mine. And I had Filipino parents, and he had a Japanese mother and a Polish father. And but seeing like it, with my father, how much he loved music and other art. In fact, I became friends with Chuck because of opera. But my father instilled opera in me, and how my mother was not the type of person who really liked these movies very much. She just wasn't really
didn't find them very important.
I mean, my dad might have liked like Blue Hawaii or something with like Elvis, but he wasn't like a big movie buff. But I believe that they saw in me a passion that they just thought, well, let's just see what happens. We trust them. He's, you know, hopefully he won't screw up too bad or whatever. But I was well advantaged with their care, and I I hope on some level that the film could be a testament that, you know, at least it wasn't misplaced. But yeah.
Well, what's next for Alan Blanco? What kind of film do you want to make next?
I certainly would like to do another movie soon, but that would be on land, would be nice. you know, we're very much open to getting back and exploring. I mean, there was such a long research project in a lot of ways for this, and we're now, our craft is much better. We can tell stories faster, but we're still going out there and finding new stories. And
you know, yeah. I'm kind of curious to know when it's made the rounds at film festivals and has done exceedingly well. When will it be coming to a movie theater near us?
Well, I know our U.S. release is soon. Unfortunately, I don't know the exact dates. I do believe it's probably near the end of March. It'll be sort of a limited run. I think we'll be in New York and probably L.A. and some other cities. I don't entirely know exactly what the order would be, and I'm not entirely sure that it's always set in stone. It might be one of those things that maybe grows as some support for the film continues, and maybe there's more people who want it in different places, and we'll be flexible to try to get there. It will be seen in theaters, though, here, and I'm very happy that the fruits of our labor can also be experienced here. We had a great premiere at Tribeca, where Joe won Best New Narrative Director, and that was a great homecoming for most of us.
Amazing for a first time out. I mean, just absolutely amazing. I have one other question, because I think a lot of people watching are saying, how, you know, there are 600,000 jobs, something in that neighborhood, in the film industry, and many times more who are interested in working in it. So what advice would you have for young people who want to do what you're doing for a living?
I would say that it has never been easier and cheaper to work on your craft as a narrative storyteller. It could be in any medium, but specifically with filmmaking, you can go and get consumer to prosumer level cameras. You can work on this, on your shooting and your storytelling, and just developing that voice. I think it's a little bit more populous, I guess, and then even exhibiting and distributing your material is easier now than it has been before. There's a lot of voices.
Because of the internet.
Exactly. There's a lot of voices to be heard through, but I do think being able to work on your craft is always necessary to grow. And I think that's something that a lot of barriers have been taken down with. I mean, before it was just a Super 8 camera, but even then there were certain limitations to how much you could pay to get the film and develop it, and whether or not there was a lab even near you. And now if you have a decent computer and a pretty okay camera, if you go out with a couple friends and you just work and just also enjoy yourself but discover things and work really hard, I think you really can grow faster. I think younger filmmakers today probably know twice as much as I ever did at their age, if not more. And that's exciting, though. That's also really exciting. And then I think the way people ingest and discover visual media is going to be in faster in ways.
You know, when someone your age is talking about the shelf life of knowledge, it's a little scary for someone my age. You know. Well, thanks so much, and best wishes to you in what I'm sure is going to be a spectacular career.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
That was filmmaker Alan Blanco. The Penn State graduate's debut film, Manos Sucias, is a deeply affecting story set and shot in the drug underworld of Buenaventura, Colombia. Rotten Tomatoes gave the film a 91%. To learn more about the film and the filmmakers, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.